I had the chance recently to sit down with Father Mike Schmitz, the author of How to Make Great Decisions. Our conversation covered everything from how much coffee he drinks and who his favorite superhero is, to his work with young people, his life as a priest, his insights into prayer and relationships, and his favorite material possession. Now I'm delighted to share our conversation with you. It is my hope that it will help you get to know him like never before. So, Father Mike, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much for joining us. We're super grateful and excited to have this time with you. I have a very serious question to get started, and that is, who is your favorite superhero and why?
Yes, I think that's a great question, but it actually is it's not a softball. It is just a challenging question. So I'm kind of a DC guy. There's Marvel, of course, there's DC. One has made really successful movies. The other has made really incredible comics. So it comes down to Superman and Batman, kind of the big two. And if I had to, I don't know that I could actually ever choose. If I had to go Marvel, that's easy. Captain America all the way. That's just very, very clear. But one of the things Marvel does with their characters is they always want to give them some really clear flaws, which is not horrible. It's just not why I would want to read comic books. I'd want to read comic books to get into that world. I don't necessarily need the heroes. I like the heroes to have a purpose and be driven by that purpose more than anything else.
Fantastic. So we asked on social media this morning, we asked people to submit questions. And also another very serious question from the audience is, how much coffee do you drink?
That's funny because right next to me have my coffee mug. I've only had, I would say, half of a cup today so far. And half the day's through. So I can go anywhere from a couple pots. So it's interesting because if I'm at my parents' place, my family's house, and they're just hanging out and there's someone keeps making coffee, I will keep drinking coffee. If I'm at a conference and they keep having coffee there, I'll just keep sipping on it. Not because I need it, just because it's one of those things like, oh, you might as well drink on something, sip on something warm. But I can go from one cup to maybe two pots in any given day. I've kind of a spread.
Fantastic. What about favorite sport? And is there a lesson you draw from that sport about life?
Oh gosh. Yeah. So I would say recently, maybe in the last 4 years, I never watched sports ever. I like the Olympics, love the Olympics because the Olympics were the only place that I could get the sports that I participated in. I never understood the idea of watching someone else do something you like doing yourself. Like, so I never, if you play basketball, it'd be like, well, just go play basketball. Don't watch people play basketball. The Olympics, I can understand. I ran, I swam, triathlon, cross-country skiing. Those were kind of my jam, which are not necessarily broadcast very often, except for every 4 years on TV. But within the last 4 years, I got into CrossFit and in competing in CrossFit a little bit, and not anything big, just kind of small stuff. And I find myself wanting to watch all of the time other people do this because and I kind of get what it is to be a fan now, to be able to watch and see how someone does something so excellently. It blows my mind. So that's one thing I think kind of a takeaway is from sports is this pursuit of excellence and this decision to, I can choose to be great. The other piece that I love about sports, it's one of the reasons I think everyone should be in sports or in music or in theater or anywhere you can fail, is that hopefully sports teach you how to fail. And I think that's probably one of the best lessons that anyone could possibly learn is how to fail. And I think that's one of the best lessons that sports offer to young people.
That's a fantastic insight. I think it's, as a parent, it's hard to let your children fail.
Oh yeah.
And it's so important, you know. We talk here a lot about the idea that, you know, parents' role isn't to prepare the road for their child, but to prepare their child for the road.
Right.
And there is failure on the road. So that's a fantastic insight. What about, you know, you've touched a lot of people and so they're naturally curious about you. Tell us a little bit about, like, growing up. What was Father Mike like growing up, and what was growing up like for Father Mike?
Yeah, I would say that if you can sum it up in one word, I would say I was a punk, but probably wasn't that much of a punk. kind of a, so I would say this, I was raised in a Catholic family. So I had my mom and dad who both are Catholic and brought us all to church. I'm one of six kids, three boys and three girls. And so when it came to faith, there was the rule that we have to go to Mass every single Sunday. And I would say that the only reason, my parents said, only way you could get out of going to Sunday Mass was if you're too sick to do anything for the rest of the day, too sick to do anything else. And so there were times when I disliked going to Mass so much that I would pretend to be sick, get out of 1 hour of Mass, but then have to sit in my room the entire rest of the day. This is, you know, before devices, before phones, before computers, before TVs in rooms. Like, it basically being in your room by yourself meant sitting on your bed, doing nothing. And for whatever reason, I thought that was a good trade-off. Like, I disliked going to Mass so much that I thought, that's not bad. I got 1 hour free. Now I have the rest of the day in captivity, but at least I didn't have to go to church. And all of that changed. I remember I actually even had fifth, sixth grade, somewhere in there, where one of our teachers, she was a substitute teacher, and she was playing Christian music at some point. And I was at a Catholic school, and she said, oh, is this one of those? She played Christian music, and I said, are you one of those Jesus freaks? And I have no idea why, where did I ever hear that phrase? My parents didn't talk like that. Where would I even say this? And she's like, what are you talking about? I was like, this sounds like one of those Jesus freak songs. And she says, yes, I am. And you know what? One day you are going to be too. And I was like, no way. And she says, wait a second. Jesus is going to get a hold of you. And when he does, you just better watch out. And I was like, whatever. And then when I was about 15 or 16, I had this big moment of conversion and where Jesus got a hold of me. And it started, it was pretty private, pretty personal. Wasn't in a group, wasn't through any like big, no one gave a talk. I didn't read a book. What happened was I just had this personal awareness at one point of my own sin. I mean, that was what it was. It was, I had heard all the sins were for, you know, my whole life growing up. And those were all, yep, I know what they are. They're on the list. They're on the tablets. But all of a sudden there was this awareness that, oh my gosh, that's what I do. Like sin is something that's in me now. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, like I can't just forgive myself. I can't just save myself. I need a savior. And it was like one of those bing, like, oh my goodness. That's what they've been telling me my entire life, is that Jesus is the savior. And I realized, oh my gosh, now I get what that means. I had been given the answer before I had the question. And I'd been given the lifeline before I knew that I needed it. And so in that moment, it was so clear. I knew I needed to pray. I knew I needed to go to confession. And so the prayer route started at one point. You can talk about that if you ever want to. But I remember confession. I didn't know you're supposed to wait until Saturday to go. So I knew where the priest lived. And so I got on my bike and I rode across town 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, knocked on the priest's door. And I always say, of course, he was home because priests only work one day a week. And I said, Father, can I go to confession? Sure, come on in. I sat down on the couch and went to confession. And I remember walking out of that rectory, stepping on the front porch, and three thoughts were so clear in my mind. One was just, God, thank you so much. Because I had felt the weight of sin to a degree. I had felt that. And I just, God, thank you so much for, you've completely forgiven me of all of my sins. My second thought was, God, if you ever want me to be a priest, I will hear anyone's confession anytime they ask. And I never thought about being a priest before. I mean, maybe when I was really, really little, but never entertained it seriously. But that was the first time I ever just, God, if you want. So the first two thoughts, one, God, thank you so much. Second, if you ever want me to be a priest, I will hear anyone's confession whenever they ask. My third thought was, oh, she's really cute. Like, so that started this battle of like, gosh, what do you want me to do, Lord? But then, you know, I did read some books and did encounter the truth of Jesus in the Eucharist in a way that just blew me away. I encountered the reality of the life of prayer that we're meant to be called into, that just can transform my life. But it all started, like Pope Benedict said in God is Love, where he says, being a Christian is not the result of an ethical choice or a lofty ideal. It's the result of an encounter with a person that gives one's life gives one's life a new horizon and sets it in a decisive direction. And I can trace so much back to stepping on that front porch and realizing, okay, Lord, from that moment you gave my life a new horizon and you set me in a decisive direction. And that was pretty big. Of course, I had all the same things. I was still in sports and still loved high school. I was one of the weird people who liked high school. That's a whole nother story.
That's fantastic. So would you say, you know, that moment on the porch, is that the moment where the faith became your faith, or is there another moment that you define in that way?
Yeah, that was a big moment. It's all part of that same process. It was started with this awareness of sin. It started with, it continued, and really the encounter of Jesus in confession, just really knowing his love. So it, very similar, but it was all part of the oh my gosh, I need him. He's been given to me. And then there was two other pieces. One is learning how to pray. And the other was learning about Jesus in the Eucharist. Mm. And all of those things just relayered, because learning how to pray wasn't just a one-time thing. And that was how do I show up for prayer? And if this is real, I have to do this. If this is real, then I need to spend time with him. I mean, even as a high schooler, it was very, very clear. And then I remember reading in a book about the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. And it's crazy. I went downstairs and told my siblings, like, you guys, do you know that Jesus really is truly present in the Eucharist? They're like, yeah. I'm like, no, he's like really present. Like, they're looking at me like, we've all went to Catholic school too. We know this. I'm like, I don't know if I was sick that day. I don't know if I didn't pay attention. I know I didn't pay attention. But it that changed everything. And just recognizing not only God's love for me personally in confession, there's forgiveness of sins, but also in the mass, in the Eucharist. And so everything changed. I mean, then from then on, I never wanted to skip mass again. It was just a matter of, okay, I need to be there. But yeah, the way to say it is that is the season where the faith became my faith. Yeah.
Fantastic. So that's, you know, it's just over 30 years ago since you stepped on that porch.
Yeah.
How does Jesus continue to amaze you today?
Oh my gosh. That is such a great question, because, you know, that was the beginning in so many ways. I mean, the real beginning was baptism, all those, but I can look back at that moment or that season with such great fondness, but recognizing that the Lord is here now. And I can look back with gratitude and fondness, and also I can learn a lot. You know, Jesus in the book of Revelation talks about one of the words for the churches, I think it's the church at Ephesus, is that, you know, you're doing all the right things and you believe all the right things and you're doing okay. But this thing I have against you is you lost your first love. Mm-hmm. And so I can look back at times and that season and say, okay, Lord, how am I doing? Am I really pursuing you with the same abandon as I did at first? Am I still loving you with the same love that I did at first? And what I mean by same love, I mean with that same, I want you to have my whole heart. You know, I think sometimes we settle into just kind of rhythms that are comfortable as opposed to rhythms that really stretch us and say, I following you, Lord, costs me something. It costs me my whole heart. And like, well, no, but I've got comfortable things around me. I've got this really nice chair behind me. I've got, you know, comfortable room that I'm in right now, as opposed to saying, Lord, it's all yours. And so what I've experienced since then is that depth of God gets to claim everything else. He gets to claim everything. Initially it was, you get to claim my sins. Thank you, Lord. Thank you. Get to take those away from me. But he has to be able to have access to every part of my life. And that's one of the things that I keep coming back to every single day in prayer, is that he has to have access to all of it.
It's powerful. You know, the phrase like wholehearted is so common in our society. I've been meditating just on that phrase over the last couple of weeks, and meditating, what have I done in my life in a wholehearted way? What am I doing in my life in a wholehearted way now? And it's interesting how we can get to a place of wholeheartedness and then regress from that wholeheartedness, but still think that we're there. And that's why it's just so important, I think, to check back in from time to time. You know, you spend a lot of time working with young people, mm-hmm. young adults, which is beautiful and so needed and necessary. What would you say is young people's greatest need today? As you're working with these young people, what strikes you as, oh, this is their greatest need? Like, there's these great moments in the Gospels where Jesus just surveyed the crowd and he recognized some yearning in them, some longing in them, some need in them. As you survey all the young people you're working with today, what is their greatest need?
It's a great question, because there's so many needs. Obviously, in the last year, we've experienced the need for others, need for community, need for real friendship, the need to be able to be together. I mean, just like there's so much isolation. And, you know, as scripture says, Jesus saw the crowd and felt pity on them because they were frightened and abandoned like sheep without a shepherd. I think there's an abandonment that grips a lot of the young people these days, or even a fear of abandonment. They can have even intact families that they're coming from, the families of origin, and still have that fear of abandonment. Because relationships are so transitory, even in stable families, they see like, well, be it my extended family, have my aunt and uncle walked away from each other or whatever, you know, just they, all their friends. So there's that transitoriness. There's that isolation. But one of the things that I would say is, I believe that we are in a crisis. One of the crises that they experience most profoundly is meaninglessness. I think that, and not just, well, I found my own meaning, or I found my bliss, I found my purpose, but the greater substantial kind of meaning that is objective, that you can build a life on, that when all the storms of life attack, or when there's isolation, all these other things, all the plans you had are falling through, to know that, okay, but this all means something, that this isn't an accident. And I think that a lot of our culture and a lot of what they are presented with, or what we're presented with, because we're living in the culture too, is so temporary and is so based on, subjective experience, that what happens when that subjective experience is all just pain? What happens when that subjective experience is so confusing that I don't understand it? And there's got to be something more. And so I would say that there's the greatest need, the greatest wound is a crisis of meaning, because it touches every single aspect of their lives.
And so if, you know, someone came to you and just said, hey, I feel like I'm drowning in meaninglessness.
Yeah.
Desperate for purpose. What would you say is the first step? What is the first step you would encourage them to take?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I want to spell it out and say that you're not an accident, that your life is not an accident, that you're not, you don't have to just happen to exist, because that is the presentation. The idea is a materialist worldview is that no, you're just a random cosmic, you're stardust. The reason you're special is because you're dust of stars. Like, that's not special. If everything's made of stardust, that doesn't mean anything. So to be able to say, okay, one of the things you need to realize is that you're not an accident, that you have been made on purpose, that your life has been made for purpose, and then you get to live on purpose. But one of the things that happens is you believe your life is an accident, then we just walk through life off purpose. We walk through life on accident. But if you've been made for purpose, then you get to live on purpose. And there's even something that's just kind of like to present a base level of even just that. You're not an accident. You're made on purpose. You actually have the ability to live on purpose is an invitation I've seen so many people respond to in a really positive and powerful way.
Fantastic. You know, I think a lot of young people, they suffer, well, people of all ages suffer under the weight of shame, mm-hmm. of self-loathing, of regret. Do you have a regret in your life? And how have you made peace with that regret?
Yeah. I think that, you know, there are some people who say never regret anything in life because it brought you to where you are today and made you the person you are today. And that is, I mean, I can understand the truth of that, but I don't know that it's completely true. In one sense, that what if you're a worse person now because of that experience? And so what if I'm a worse person because of that experience? So on one hand, there's a truth there, 100%. There's a truth there. But at the same time, I think it makes sense to be able to have some things that we've lived through, things we've chosen that if I had to do it over again, I would have chosen differently. Now, here's what, as Christians, we believe God can use it all. Absolutely. God can use every single mistake we've made, every single sin he can write a great story even in the midst of our brokenness. So I have absolute confidence and faith in that. But I also know that those things, those elements of my life that I wish I hadn't chosen, what I get to do now is like, this is the what I'll do. And when I feel overwhelmed by that, so you mentioned shame, you mentioned maybe some embarrassment or guilt and that regret, I can't go back in time and change that. What I can do is I can take all of it and place it under his dominion. And I know that's a kind of a fancy way of saying this, but I surrender it to him and say, okay, God, I can't do anything about this. This is the situation. This is how it happened. These are the consequences that I'm living with right now, and I can't change any of them. So what I'm going to do is I submit them to you. I surrender them to you, and I place them under your lordship. I place it under your dominion, and say, you get to be Lord of that too. You get to be Lord of my broken past. You get to be the Lord of the consequences that I'm living through right now that I wish I didn't. I could change if I could, but you get to be Lord of it. You get to have access to it. And what I found is I found so much freedom in that. Because there's nothing that he can't do something with. There's nothing, no element of our life that God can't do something with, and including the sources of our shame and some of the sources of our guilt.
So as you're making your journey and you're coming alongside people, ministering to them, do you see God using your broken past to minister to those people?
Yeah, I even see God using my broken presence to minister to people. There is there is an element where when it's surrendered to him, he uses it all. So here's an example. I can talk to about myself, but here's someone who's very close to me that for years, he's an older man, and for years, he we've talked about this. He said, I invite people to church all the time, but no one's ever said yes. He's like, what's up with this? I invite people all the time. He'd say, I need to go out and evangelize. I need to go and welcome people to the church. And no one ever says yes. And I was like, I don't know. Keep trying, I guess. This individual at one point had to go to rehab for alcoholism and goes to meetings at least once a week, talks with his sponsor at least once a day, and is an active part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've seen in this person's life so much where now when he invites people, they respond. Now when he comes out of this place of before, a place of I'm put together, I've got it all figured it out, I've got it all under control. I'm not going to go with you. But now where he comes out of a place of just not excessive, I have my badge that says I'm an alcoholic, but out of a place of humility and a place of I'm approaching others as one who is broken. People have responded so powerfully to his invitation to come close to the Lord that it's incredible. And I see that happen in his life all the time, and I hope it happens in mine too.
That's fantastic. You know, we're dealing with sort of epidemic levels of addiction in our culture of all types. What would you say to someone who is struggling with an addiction?
I think that it all depends on where they're at. As we know that there's some people who point to addiction as an excuse. I find that a lot. Then people who say, well, I have this addiction, therefore I can't stop this particular behavior. And for them, I would have a different word than those who are in denial. Like if it's for someone who's like, I have this addiction, so I don't. It's kind of like any other disease. Think of another kind of mental illness, like say depression or something like this. I can't not be depressed. If I am diagnosed with depression, I can't just not be depressed, but I can continue to take my medication, and I can continue to talk to my therapist, and I can continue to show up for those kind of meetings. So I can't just eliminate the problem, but that doesn't mean I can't. Just because I can't do everything doesn't mean I can't do anything. And so that's one thing. So if someone is at that place when it comes to addiction and they're saying, I'm just going to blame my behavior on my addiction. Okay. On the other hand, there is so much, again, go back to the word shame. So much shame when it comes to the wounds that we all carry. And every one of us carries wounds. And some of the wounds that we are most ashamed about, that have the most power over us, are the secret wounds. And sometimes addiction is that. It's a secret wound for so many people. And so we have to ask the question, would it have more power or less power in your life if you brought it out into the light?
Mm.
Would it be easier to carry if you allowed someone else to carry it with you? Or would it crush you even more? And I have found so often that people keep themselves back. They hold themselves back from real freedom because they don't want to reach out for help. And I understand that, but at the same time, I don't understand it, because freedom is possible and sobriety is possible and a new life is possible. And I just think that as long as there are those lies that keep attacking us from inside, saying you can't let anyone know, that no one's there to help, that I tried once and I got shot down, all those kind of pieces, to recognize that you're not over and your life's not over, and freedom can be in your future.
That's fantastic. What we're talking about, like, our aspiration to be all God created us to be. We're talking about our humanity. One thing I notice a lot of people struggle with, I see it a lot in moms, you know, and it's like, okay, you're a mom, but before you're a mom, and before you're a wife, and before you're a daughter, and before you're a sibling, you're an individual human being, you know, and you have a mandate from God, you know, you have a responsibility to yourself as an individual human being. Before you're a priest, before you're a speaker, before you're an author, before you're all of those other things, you're a human being. How do you honor that in the midst of all your other roles and responsibilities?
Yeah, that's, and not only, I would say that my deepest identity would be a son of God, that I can't summarize or express any more deeply, any more central, any more core of who I am as other than an adopted son of God. And so that has to come first. I know that it's so easy, as you're mentioning, as your question even mentions, how it's so easy to say, well, I've got to get all this work done. This is the task that needs to be accomplished. This is the person who needs to be taken care of. And yet, at the same time, there is a primary relationship. And the primary relationship that gives me my identity is between the Father and myself. And so I would say that if I haven't taken the time for prayer, and say, okay, let's rephrase accurately, when I haven't taken time for prayer. And when I say taking time for prayers, is I know that what is necessary. I know what kind of prayer is necessary. I know how long I need to be in prayer for it to be the kind of prayer that actually goes to the identity and actually helps the relationship. And I also know what kind of prayer it has to be. It can't be prayer where I'm also writing a homily. It can't be prayer where I'm also writing a talk. It has to be where it's just, okay, Lord, this is us together. It can be brief, but the agenda has to be love. And without that, there's nothing else. And I think a person could continue to work, but they wouldn't work with, they could keep working, but it wouldn't keep working. I think that kind of fuel runs out pretty quickly.
Absolutely. You're working with young people, you know, what advice do you have for young people about love?
Mm. I can't remember who it was who said this. Dom Cambera, maybe might've been the name of the man. He said something like, life teaches us how to love. I like how in the Christian context, what John Paul II said, which is that the family is the school of love. And so in that case, like, life doesn't just teach us how to love. Life could also teach us how to become bitter. Life could teach us how to resent. But a life lived with Christ teaches us how to love. And one of the things that life with Christ teaches us, one of the aspects of love that life with Christ teaches us, is that you are always free to choose to love. Mm-hmm. You're always free to choose to love. That the gift of the emotion of love is a gift. It is real, and it's a real gift. But I'm not beholden to it, and you don't have to be a slave to that. That you can actually choose to love regardless of your feelings. You actually get to lead your feelings when it comes to love. And that it's actually possible to keep your promises. And that's an element, again, going back to John Paul II, where he said, a person who does not promise to love for a lifetime will never truly be able to love, truly love for even one day.
Mm.
Because there's that sense that it can't just be transitory. It has to be, it has to have an element that says, I will, I mean, when it comes down to this, I always highlight for our couples when I do marriage prep with them that on your wedding day, you're going to make some vows, which is kind of silly in some ways, meaning you're going to make a vow to be faithful to each other, to love each other, to honor each other on your wedding day, which is silly because of course you are that day. Of course, on your wedding day, of course, you're going to love each other. You're going to be faithful to each other. You're going to honor each other. The reason you're making a vow on your wedding day is because you know that the day is going to come when you won't feel like loving each other, when you won't want to be faithful to each other, when you don't want to honor each other. And what you're saying is, when that day comes, I promise you, I still will love you, and I will still choose you, and I will still be faithful to you, and I will still honor you. And that kind of thing is something I wish that more people knew, because that's possible. It's possible to love like that.
So as I listen to you speak about love. You're building your whole description of love and story of love and philosophy of love on the idea that love is a choice, but the culture is sending a message very, very powerfully in music, in books, in TV shows, in movies, that love is a feeling. How do you draw people out of the love is a feeling philosophy and into the love is a choice philosophy?
Yeah, I think that, I think life has to teach them that. And what I mean by I think what Dom Kimbera was saying, that life teaches us how to love in the sense that there are some relationships that are, say, even romantic relationships, but they also can be relationships of friendship that are only for a season, and that's okay. So there is an element where just because we're dating doesn't mean that I'm going to love you forever. And that's okay. Just because we're friends in geometry class doesn't mean that we're friends after school. And that's okay. That there can be an element of different kinds of friendship. There's friendships for a season and the friendships for life. There's love for a season, there's love for life. To be able to recognize, okay, that's possible. Both things can be true at the same time. That there are such things as kind of more transitional type friendships and relationships, but there's also a great gift that comes along with a permanent or more permanent friendship and a vow to love. And I think that oftentimes the young people that I deal with, or I get to, you know, interact with, one of the things that they're seeing is like, wait a second. So I'm dating this person. I mean, this is forever. Like, well, maybe, but hold your horses. Or the opposite, which is there's no such thing as forever. And so I think that as they mature, I don't want to say edges get worn off. What I mean is I think things come into focus where I could recognize there are such things as friendships and relationships for a season. And there are such things as friendships and relationships for life. And part of the wisdom of living is being able to discern which one is which.
What is, so we're talking about love, and there's a youthfulness to love. And I think love keeps us young.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for married couples who've been married for 20, 30, 40 years?
Well, they haven't figured it out yet. I always think of kind of two things. One is, especially if they've, well, to be careful with each other. I think that that is one thing that I see happening a lot when it comes to even newly married couples, is they get to a place where we're so comfortable with each other that we stopped being careful with each other. And I don't mean fragile way. I don't mean walking on eggshells, But I do mean, if I've noticed that I'm treating strangers more politely than I'm treating my spouse, something's wrong. If I notice that I'm treating people at work with more care than I'm treating my spouse, then something's off. That this should be the relationship that I'm being most careful with, because this is the one that matters the most and it's the one that's going to last the longest. So one is just, even just simple, just be careful with each other. Second one is, if someone has revealed themselves to you, stop waiting for them to change. Maybe I'll say it like a different way. I have found that newly married couples are more patient with the foibles and inconsistencies and wounds of their spouse than couples that have been married for a long time, which I think should be the opposite. And on one hand, you might think, well, of course, that by this point, they're just tired of it. And they just like, I don't have any patience for you. But I look at that and think, wait, if you've been reminding him to put down the toilet seat for the last 25 years, or if he's been waiting, you know, just like, I'm so frustrated. She's always late. She's always running late when we have to go somewhere. Why would you give that permission to stress you out in any way, shape, or form? It's been 25 years. If you haven't learned yet, he doesn't put down the toilet seat. She is always late. If you haven't learned that by now, the problem is not with them. The problem is with you at this point. And so I would say that, yeah, I've been married for a long time. Realize this is the person I married, and be able to not just accept, but also maybe even delight in those little idiosyncrasies, those little things that's like, of course, yeah, we're going to be late and I'm not going to let it bother me. Or yeah, the seat's this way and I'm not going to let it bother me, because if this toilet seat up meant he doesn't actually love me, he would have left me a long time ago. And if her being late means she doesn't respect me, then this is the least of my problems. But probably it's just that he is forgetful. Probably it's just that she has a lot on her mind and happens in taking care of everyone else before she takes care of herself. And that's where we're at. And I think there's an element of acceptance of the other person that would bring a lot of peace to couples that have been married for a long time.
Excellent insight. So we're talking about relationships, and a big part of relationships is communication. And I've heard you talk about conversations before. What is the most important part of any conversation?
That's a great question. I would think that on some level it'd be understanding. Meaning I didn't just say what I wanted to say. You understand what I was trying to communicate. But I think that there are so many times in the course of any given day or any given situation where there's not enough time necessarily to clarify. Okay, you said you wanted the blue mittens, not the red ones. They're blue mittens with red stripes. Okay, you know, where, yes, that's what I said. Blue mittens, red stripes, both left and right hand, or whatever the thing is. Sometimes there's not enough time to communicate these things in a way that I know you understand me and you know that I understand you. So the most important part of communication would be, I think, what might be the most important part of any relationship, and that is more foundational, I think, than love, is respect. And more foundational and respect is built, love and respect are built off of trust. And so that sense of being able to say, oh, I'm sorry, I bought the blue mittens with the red stripe, not the red mittens with the blue stripe, or whatever the thing is. But if that person knows they can trust me, that person knows they can trust that I respect them and I love them. And if I had remembered, I would have gotten the mittens they wanted, then we're going to be okay. Because I know at the end of the day, the most important part of communication is the relationship itself. And if that relationship itself is built off of a mutual love and respect undergirded by trust, then I think that words are going to be words, but this is the relationship.
In your book, How to Make Great Decisions, you talk about like learning to listen to God, you know, and one of the things I love is how, like, you make connections between our faith life and the practical realities of our everyday. And so as I'm listening to you speak, you know, about this knowing, this understanding, this trusting, and I'm putting that together with the piece in the book about learning to listen to God. How does learning to listen to God make us a better listener in relationships?
Wow. Yeah. I think on one, and for myself, when it comes to prayer, one of the things that I wanted is I wanted God to speak to me the way it seemed like he spoke to others. Here is Samuel, who's living in the temple, and he hears his God calling his voice, Samuel, Samuel. And he goes to Eli and says, you called me. I know I didn't call you. And then later on, it's revealed that this is the Lord God calling Samuel. And I'm like, yeah, talk to me like that, Lord. I don't mind. I'd like to hear the audible voice, you telling me what to do. And then realizing that, God, you get to talk to me however you want. Like, you actually get to communicate with me how you want, not necessarily how I prefer. And there's something about that is a humbling. And also, it translates really, really well into our relationships with others. Meaning, if I'm going to expect someone else to think the way I think, I'm going to expect them to do something they can't do. If I'm going to expect someone to always talk the way that, or speak the way I speak, then I'm going to be expecting them to do something that they don't have the capacity to do. And so when it comes to the Lord, I want to say, okay, God, speak to me how you, I want to learn how you speak to me. And think when it comes to other people is the same thing is, okay, I want to learn how you speak to me, my spouse, my friend, my child. Even that's another thing is that, you know, for parents and children, that recognition that, one's kids are not just carbon copies. They might look similar, but they have their own minds, their own way of understanding things, their own way of getting from A to B, their own way of communicating those things. And so there's a massive level of, I get to accept that you have a different mind than I do. You have a different way of speaking than I do. And it's my job to learn how you speak. And that's what I think we've done with that we strive to do when it comes to the Lord. And then when we do that well, we can realize we do that with everybody.
So we're talking, you know, about relationships, and every relationship is an opportunity to become a better version of ourselves.
Yeah.
If you could put together a dinner party and invite a handful of people from history, anyone in history, who would you invite to dinner?
That's a great question. And it's one that I think, well, here's one submission, one potential guest list. And I think that I might, the group that comes to me is, one might be the Apostles. The other might be a group called the Inklings, right? So C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien and Matthew Barfield, I think, is another one of them, some other folks. And the reason why is because it's a group of friends who had this virtuous friendship. And one of the things that they did together is they, here's the apostles, they're completely different, but united in their love and experience of Jesus, and united in their being commissioned by Christ himself. The Inklings, same kind of thing, united in their love of literature, but also in their pursuit of the Lord. And that to me, I'm an introvert, if we have to go to a dinner party, I would like to be at a dinner party where they're all friends and I get to kind of listen in on their conversation. So that's kind of where I would go. But that's just right off the top of my head.
Love it. Love it. So let's shift a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the life of Jesus and the scriptures. And, you know, if you could go into one moment of the life of Jesus, if you could have been there for one moment, which moment would you choose?
Wow. I will, you know, in my mind, I'm going all the way from the big moments. I'll get back to that in a second, but also the small moments where it's, the day-to-day with the Lord. So there's the scenes from the Gospels that would be incredible. I mean, I think it'd be incredible on one hand to be able to be with the Lord in the Garden of Gethsemane and to know what that moment means and to be there for Jesus in a unique way, to be able to say, to whatever degree I can, I get it. To be able to give him that. On the other hand, it'd be incredible to be able to be there at the moment of the resurrection and just to bear witness to that incredible reality. And so those are some of the big moments. But again, so I love going to the Holy Land. I love going to Israel. And one of the things I love about Israel is I love returning to those normal places and just think, okay, the Lord walked here, or he saw that hill, or this is what the air smelled like when he was walking down Mount Arbel towards the Sea of Galilee. And those elements of just be able to walk with him, to be able to be on that hike with him would be remarkable. But sometimes these days, I think I've been there maybe a dozen times or so now. These days, some of my favorite parts of the pilgrimage is when we're just hanging out at the hotel afterwards. And it's just this chance to be eating some food, like having a beer, and just enjoying each other's presence. And so I think some of those moments are the moments I really would love to be able to have with the Lord. The big moments are awesome, but maybe even some of those small moments of just having dinner, going for a walk.
So I love the Holy Land as well. I love watching other people discover it for the first time and experience where Jesus walked for the first time and walk where Jesus walked. You know, you talked earlier about like this idea of virtuous friendship and a group of friends who are challenging and encouraging each other to become the best version of themselves. And when you imagine Jesus just walking down the dusty roads with the disciples, what do you imagine that was like?
Right. So I have the image. I've had a chance, opportunity to hike a bunch in my life or camp a bunch in my life. And one of the things that happens when you're on those kind of journeys is you kind of either pair up or you're kind of triple up and then drop back, and people are joining and rejoining groups. And one of the things that just strikes me is the naturalness of, you know, you just kind of drop back a little bit because you want some quiet time. Or you join up with this other group because you what are they talking about up there? Or you get to just even again walk next to the Lord and have that opportunity to just maybe even not even say anything, but be able to be walking with him and just being in his presence, going the same direction, knowing you're headed the same direction. I keep having that. Yeah, that's what I keep imagining is those pair ups, those dropping back, those walking with the Lord. I imagine it'd be a lot where there'd be laughter. I imagine that there'd be some times when it was, you know, Jesus set his face like flint to Jerusalem and he decided I'm going to go there and I'm going to announce to you all that what's going to happen when I get there. So maybe less laughter in those situations, but that would be incredible too, to see how does the Lord face, how does he do this walk? How does he do this walk where he knows what's at the end of the road? I think it would be pretty remarkable.
Awesome. If, you know, someone is, you've helped so many people discover the Bible and rediscover the Bible. And if there's someone listening and watching who has never read the Bible, but feels called, feels drawn, what one piece of practical advice would you give to someone approaching the Bible for the first time?
Maybe practical advice would be let the Bible be what it is and not what you want it to be.
Mm.
I think that could really help a lot of people.
What about parents? You know, you're ministering to young people. They all have parents. As I've traveled around the world the past decades, I see a lot of anguish in Catholic parents whose children have fallen away from the church. What advice would you have for those parents?
Yeah, I think that it's easy to feel powerless because the only person you can control is yourself, and you can't even control that person very well a lot of times. So it's really easy to feel powerless, and yet parents aren't powerless. parents not only have the ability to continue to give witness, I mean, and that's the thing, to be able to continue to give witness, even if your children are grown and out of the house, is profound. What I mean by that is, say someone has walked away, to always leave a way back. Someone has left, okay, but there's always, I'm leaving this door open, there's always a way back, to make that clear. And that is modeling the love of the Father. It's loving, it's modeling the prodigal father, you know, in the parable. Another thing is the power of a parent's blessing, the power of a parent's prayer, and the power of a parent's penance. I think that that a willingness to really, you know, Jesus, when there was a demon that the apostles could not drive out, he said, this one can only be driven out by prayer and fasting. And I think that there is, and there's the evil one, and the evil one wants the souls, he wants our souls, he wants the souls of our children, our family, the people we love. And to be able to say, you have these powerful tools, you have the ability to give witness to the Lord, you have the ability to keep that door open, you have the ability to pray, you have the ability to continue to fast, you have the ability to do penance for your kids. And that is not, those are not some little things. Those are not small things. They are powerful things.
Mm. As we're talking almost every topic, what strikes me is the celebration of choice, that we do have choice, that we are free to choose. We're making thousands of decisions in our lives.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I love about your book, How to Make Great Decisions, is that we're just making so many decisions. And most people have never thought, okay, what is my process for making a decision? How do I make great decisions? How do I give wisdom a place in my decision-making process? Walk us through a little bit, like, what is your decision-making process? How do you counsel and coach other people to make decisions?
Yeah. Well, you know, Christian Smith, who is a sociologist, he used to be based out of North Carolina, I think Chapel Hill, but now he works at Notre Dame. He had done this nationwide survey on the moral lives of American young adults. And one of the things he and his team found, was that after researching thousands and thousands of young adults in America, 18 to 29, I think it was, he found, the conclusion they came to was that the vast majority, over 66% of American young adults, had neither the ability nor the categories to make moral decisions.
Hmm.
And what he meant by that is not the ability, because he's like, well, not the categories. They didn't have the words for it. They didn't have the words to be able to communicate. This is what good is. This is what bad is. In fact, sometimes the words they would use, instead of saying something was bad, they would say, oh, this is merely stupid. You're being stupid, that kind of a thing. So they didn't have the categories of either right or wrong. They also didn't have the categories of the act itself, the intention, the circumstances, those kind of things. But then the ability to make moral decisions. And he could say that because he said that so often a person would appeal to how they felt. They just appeal to their gut and say, I don't know how I chose it. It felt right. I kind of sort of wanted to do it. And so I just based that decision off of a feeling. Now, there's such a thing as intuition, obviously. But how do you develop intuition? And so when it comes to making decisions, whether they be moral decisions or otherwise, I think that there's a number of things we can do. And one is we can gather data. And I think that gathering data is one of the most basic things any one of us can do, but it's also something that we often can overlook. So for example, just look at the example of discerning a college to go to and say, okay, I don't know, should I go to this college or this college? You know, college X or college Y? I don't even know. Well, okay, what are some points of data that you might want to even just discover? Well, this college X costs this much, college Y costs this much. Well, I don't know, are there any scholarships? Well, gather data. What is campus life like? Okay, gather data. And so all those things are just, you're not solving the problem, but think of it in terms of variables. You're trying to solve for X, but you also have all these unknowns. You have Y and Z and W and all these things. Well, if you can fill in some of those letters with actual numbers, with data, then you have a better idea, at least, of how to solve for X. So data gathering. The second is, I think, counsel. So counsel is very similar to data gathering, but it's not It can be. I mean, you can seek counsel from somebody and get more data that way. But also, counsel can often help process the data, because there's a lot that I don't know. I don't know how to process whether college X that costs this much and college Y that costs this much, how that could be offset by scholarships or by whatever, but someone else might. So seek counsel from every wise man, as scripture says. So first, gathering data. Second, seeking counsel. A third one is, I just think at some point we need to move, we need to decide. So that frightens a lot of people. We need to have courage in order to do that. Why it frightens a lot of people is because if I've decided, that means it's done. That means the decision's over. And it doesn't. What it means is I've tentatively taken a step. I've taken a step down this road that looks promising. I don't know where it's going to lead. I don't even know if this is the right step. But if I don't ever take the step, I will never know if that's the right step. And so the image I always have is the image of sighting in a rifle. So in Minnesota and other places in the country where someone goes out to go deer hunting, couple weeks before you actually go deer hunting, if you have a scope on your rifle, you go to the firing range and you line up the target in the scope or in the sights, and then you have to actually pull the trigger. So you line it up and you don't just walk away. Say, oh yeah, it looks like it's good. You have to line it up and then you have to fire. And then you see, okay, is it off in any way? Is it down into the left? Is it down into the up into the right? And if it is, you adjust and then you line it up again and fire again. And that is actually how you sight in a rifle. That's actually also how we're supposed to make decisions. We get data, we get counsel, and then we take a step and say, is this the right step? And if it's not, then we calibrate and take another step. And if calibrate and take another step, that's not failure. That's the process. And that's how it's supposed to go. It's not, I made this decision and now I just don't have to think about it anymore. It's made the decision to take one step, not to run the whole marathon.
So when you're making a decision, you know, sometimes it's hard enough to make a decision with, even if you have a rich inner life, even if you're sort of, you feel like you're in a great place in your spiritual life. It seems for a lot of people, however, even people who are committed to the spiritual journey, that making a difficult decision also coincides with a difficult time of prayer, a time when they're struggling to pray, when they're having trouble praying. When you're having trouble praying, how do you recalibrate? How do you allow God to draw you back into it? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one big piece is consistency. It's faithfulness. That I would say that hands down, consistency beats intensity every time. That recognition of I'm going to show up again, and whether prayer is full of consolation or whether it's full of difficulty, dryness, distractions, that's okay. It doesn't matter because I'm here. Secondly, I'll be back tomorrow. That sense of when it comes down to it, everything's not riding on this one prayer time. This is, and also, gosh, I mean, if I'm only seeking an answer when I go to prayer, I will often leave disappointed. Mm. But if I seek the Lord when I enter into prayer, then I'll never be disappointed. And so I think that it also, speaking of recalibration, it recalibrates our focus. Because sometimes I'll go into prayer like, okay, no, Lord, here we go. We got to figure this out. And he reminds me, I figured it out already. What this time is for you to get to know my heart. Because he already knows my heart, but that time of prayer is for me to get to know his heart and to abide in him, to rest in him, and to find him there. Yeah.
So you keep showing up, and when you keep showing up, that takes the urgency out of it. You're not, showing up and saying, all right, God, do your thing.
go.
How have you grown into that patience over the last 30 years?
Oh man, because ever since that first moment of conversion and up until ordination, every day the prayer was, God, just tell me what it is you want me to do. Do you want me to be a priest? Do you want me to marry this girl? Do you want whatever? And I remember thinking, I would even say in my prayer, just tell me. I don't care what it is. I mean, I do care what it is, but if you tell me, I'll do it. And God is so good because he will never be too late with his revealing his invitation to us, but he will also never be too early with his revealing his invitation to us. And I know this looking back now that there are so many graces that I missed that God was giving me. Cause I would go every retreat I went to, every camp I went to, every time of prayer, every mass, I wanted my one answer. That's all I wanted. And here's God who's trying to give all these other graces. But I'm like, no, I don't want those other graces. I want the answer. And I think of how ungrateful that I must have been during that whole time, because he was moving, he was acting, he was doing something in my life, but I was only paying attention to what I hadn't been given yet. I wasn't paying attention to what he was giving me. And so that was a deep conviction that it took me a while to understand and to really not just understand, but also recognize for what it is, like how deep that goes. Here's God constantly blessing, but no, until you give me the thing I'm asking for, I don't want any of those other blessings. That's one thing. That's one big thing that taught me. The other is, I remember that when the Lord finally made it very clear that he was inviting me to even just go to seminary, it was painful because I had been dating this girl for about 3 years and I knew what had happened in that relationship, but so it was very difficult. But he had prepared my heart sufficiently so that by that moment, I was able to say yes in freedom. And I would think that I've often looked back and have wondered if the Lord had even revealed that 2 weeks earlier, if my heart would have been in the right place, if it would have been in the same place. I might have still done what he asked, but it might have been more like trying to fit a round peg in a square hole. So that recognition of, in the meantime, God is giving so many blessings. Secondly, is that he's on time. He's never going to be too late, but he also will not be too early.
So you went to seminary. How is priesthood different to how you thought it would be as a seminarian?
I think I emphasized in my mind, in anticipation, I emphasized all the potential negative things that possibly could be, full. I honestly pictured the life of a priest in Northern Minnesota by myself, drafty rectory with the winter winds rattling the windows and me sitting in a rocking chair, with an Afghan on my lap, stroking my cat while I looked out over the desolate, barren wasteland of, the winter Minnesota. I thought that would be a lot of that. And I would say, and also thought, I was afraid of being lonely. I don't think I'm afraid of being alone, but I'm afraid of being lonely. And I would say that both of those fears were inaccurate. They're misplaced fears. I haven't been lonely more than 15 minutes, I think, in the last 18 years of being ordained. It's been such a gift. My life has been so full of joy and so full of the Lord, so full of like incredible people. The problem is that I don't have enough life to fit all the people in. I don't have enough capacity for all of the gifts that God has been giving. And so again, the fear was loneliness. The fear was like isolation and sadness. The reality has been the opposite. Even though I know that at some point the Lord, he has to purify my heart somehow. So he does it in a number of ways. One of those ways could be in the future of leading me into a place of loneliness, which by that point, I pray that I'll be able to see it as a gift from his hand, that sense of like, no, maybe there's loneliness, maybe there's pain, but this is because he's good and he wants me to be his fully.
It's beautiful. So you talk about these sort of different seasons in your life, different seasons in our lives. What advice would you have for someone who hasn't been to confession for a while?
Well, my advice is always go. without hesitation, go. There was a person who contacted me and said, I haven't been to confession in 50 plus years. Can I go to confession? And it was the most incredible thing. When she left, she was walking out of the confessional. She said, you're going to need to call me tomorrow to make sure I'm not dead. And I remember thinking, what does that mean? And so I contacted her the next day and said, hey, I hope you're still alive. You know, I don't know if this is a joke or this is a whatever. This is a threat. You know, wait, she's safe, not place of safety. And she wrote to me in an email. She said, I'm afraid that you thought that I was going to hurt myself. I would never hurt myself. I meant call me tomorrow to make sure that I haven't died of joy. She says that I can't believe it was 50 years. I just let these small things hold me back, allowing the Lord to forgive me, allowing me to enter into joy, allowing me to enter into the love and the life that God has for me. Cause I thought, well, I'm disqualified. I can't say this. I can't reveal this to anybody. I can't, whatever the thing is. And realized that for so much of her life, she has refused to enter into joy. And I'm just make sure I'm not dead tomorrow because of joy. And she's written many times since then, just saying like every day is a gift. And that could be you. So if someone has been away from confession for a long time, why not enter into joy? Why not put down what is weighing you down and allow the Lord to love you as you are?
Powerful. I think very often we make the assumption that people know Jesus. Let's imagine we're in a place and a time where people have never heard of Jesus. And in some ways, that's not unlike this place and time for many people.
Yeah.
How would you describe Jesus to someone who has never heard of him?
Yeah. One thing I would want to do is want to find out what they do know, or what they do imagine. Like, do you have an awareness that there's more to this life than just this life? Do you have an awareness that there's more, that you're not an accident, but you're made on purpose? Is there any awareness of that? Do you have a hope, or even a glimmer of a hope that your life is intentional, that it means something, that your choices mean something, that there is someone behind it all, or something behind it all? So I want to find out if that's the case. And if it is the case, there's that sense of being able to say, okay, then let's talk about your heart, and let's talk about your experience of life. Because my guess is your experience of life and your heart has been this, that you have a longing in your heart that you wonder if it's real. You wonder if the longing in your heart can never be really satisfied, or if you just wishful thinking, because you thought it was when I get the degree, then I'll be happy. And you got the degree and you weren't happy. You thought it was, well, yeah, but a person, I just want someone who loves me. Even when you had that relationship with that person, then I'll be happy, and you got it and you weren't completely happy. Well, maybe I have to have kids. Maybe if I have this job, maybe if I live in this place, maybe if I collect a bunch of experiences. And to be able to say, okay, there's all these pieces that you thought were going to make you happy. And so now maybe there's some bitterness. Maybe there is some disappointment. Maybe even there's some anger at being sold this lie that if you did these things, accomplished these things, got these things, then you'd be happy. I just want to let you know that all of that was a lie. Now, I'm not saying that people who told you that were liars. Maybe they didn't know any better. But at least you know this one thing, it wasn't true. But there is one, the one behind everything, the one who made this universe, the one who made it good, the one who made that heart in you that you say, but I think something in my heart is made for love. I think this thing in my chest is made for more. That one who made that heart actually made you for more, and that more is him.
Mm.
And that sense of being able to say that he revealed his heart. And his heart is one that says this. I don't know if you know this, but you know, there are a lot of religions around the world. And every one of them, you have to fight to get the god or the goddess's attention. You have to work to get them to notice you. And you have to bleed in order for them to pay attention to you or to care about you. But in this broken world, the one God who made everything, he made it good, and he made your heart. He didn't break your heart, but he made your heart. And then this world, and sin broke your heart. He entered into this world and he allowed his heart to be broken. So you would know that you have a God who has a broken heart like yours, that he allowed himself to bleed, not so you didn't have to bleed to get his attention. He came down to this earth and he became one of us, and he bled to get your attention. You don't have to give him this massive sacrifice so that he can trust you, that he gave everything so that you would trust him. And that's what his heart is, and that's who he is.
That's fantastic. Very powerful, very beautiful. There's a lot of people out there who have read your books. They've listened to you speak. You've been an inspiration to them. They admire you. They think they know you. They know parts of you.
Right.
What's one thing you would like all of those people to know about you as a human being?
Yeah. On the surface, I would say, know that I'm an introvert. And so I like people. I get recharged by being alone. But that's not something that I think matters really in the big picture of things. I think I think it's good for all of us to be reminded of, and good thing for people to be reminded about myself, is that just everyone is wounded. And everyone, and as we said before, some of the most shameful wounds we have are the ones that are secret, the ones that no one else sees. And they don't have to be scandalous. They could just be that they're that thorn in our side, right? They don't have to be something that would shake someone's faith, but every one of us is wounded, right? And so I'm not an exception to that. I'm not an exception to the rule of humanity, which is we are all walking wounded. But I also recognize that the Lord Jesus loves me in my woundedness, and he continues to call me in my woundedness, and he continues to use me in my woundedness. And so what I would want people to know is the level of woundedness and my need for prayers.
Excellent. So last two questions, one very worldly question, one very otherworldly question. We live in a material world. God has gifted us with this material world. What is one material possession that just brings you great joy? You know, it's just a thing. You understand it's just a thing, but it just brings you great joy.
Wow. That's a great question, because I've actually thought about this recently. I about a year and a half ago, I got my first buck, my first deer, but I got it by hitting it with my car. So it totaled the car, and so I had to get a new car. And it's been a year and a half almost. And virtually every time I get in the car and start it, I think, this is such an awesome car. When I drive it, I think, this is great. It's the same brand as all my other cars, basically, before this. But it's just a new model. And I just think, this is so nice. I love it so much. So my car.
That's awesome. When we turn to the otherworldly, you know, I think we don't talk enough about heaven. We don't think enough about heaven. When you reflect on heaven, what do you think about? What do you imagine? What comes to mind?
I think you're right. I think we don't think enough about heaven. And yet this is God willing, our destination. This is God willing, where we get to spend eternity. And I think many of us are, we want heaven because we don't want the other thing, but we don't want heaven for what heaven really is. And that recognition of, not only on the one hand, we have, as scripture says, a new heavens and a new earth where all creation gets redeemed. All creation is groaning as it awaits redemption. So that means that this universe will be a redeemed universe. So heaven's not simply spiritual. It's actually tangible, physical, material, but supernaturalized material world. So this completely redeemed, and also at our bodies, completely redeemed, resurrected bodies that have all the properties that God originally intended and more when it comes to Jesus Christ as the first fruits of the resurrection of the dead. Not only that, but relationships redeemed. I mean, just all these pieces, the creation redeemed, our bodies redeemed, relationships redeemed. And then the heart of heaven, which is God himself. And that sense of being able to say, man, I know my heart isn't prepared for heaven, because of the fact that I know my heart needs to be more open to the Lord than it is. And right now, heaven can't fit in my heart, or maybe I'll say that my heart can't fit into heaven yet. And so every time I go to prayer, that's what's one of the things I'm asking God to do, is God, let me love you so much that if all you ever gifted me in heaven was you, that would be enough. And so that's the heart of my prayer, is God, let me love you so much that if all you ever gifted me in heaven was you, then that would be more than enough.
It's beautiful. Amazing to be with you.
Same.
Love having this conversation. Hope we can do it again soon. God bless you. Thank you for all you're doing for the church. I know that it comes at a cost to you personally, and on behalf of everyone who has been touched by your life and your ministry, just thank you for who you are.
That means a lot. Thank you, Matthew. I really, that means a lot. And I want to thank you too, because I even actually have a homily coming up where I'm quoting you a bit. So I'm grateful for all that you've done and all that I've learned from you.
God bless you. We hope you have a great day and look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thanks. Same.
God bless.
God bless.
Thank you. Bye-bye.